Bone-chilling greetings, everyone. Those tunes are courtesy of Bobby Mackey, and you'll also be hearing Stick the Landing. And I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow.
Way back in the 30s, in the little town of Wilder, lived an old man and his lovely little daughter. They ran gambling for a living. It was the best place around. All the men would come and lay their money down. Her daddy was a jealous man, but Johanna fell in love. He kept saying the man dealt a bad hand. So deep in the night, when all the world was quiet, someone came and took her lover's life.
Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers Podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift. Whenever you listen and wherever you're listening from the scorching hot, beautiful desert to the remote mountain town, tiny village, sleepy, cozy resort town, the hustle and bustle of the big city, and of course everything in between, it is greatly appreciated. This week's special city shoutouts takes us to Kennebunk, Maine, Eaton, Colorado, Tower Hamlets, England, Freehold, New Jersey, York, Pennsylvania, and Eindhoven, Netherlands. Today we're going on a voyage in waters entrenched with legends, mysteries, haunting tales, and of course, death. Today is all about ghost ships and death ships, my friends. Like a plane, train, or automobile, you get in and you expect to make it to your destination safely. Same thing with watercrafts. It may take longer, but by golly, you damn well expect for your feet to hit land once again. That's not always the case. The Eliza battleship was a 316-ton Tumegee River steamboat. Construction ends in 1852, and it's only in service for a few years before disaster strikes. March 1st of 1858 started out like any other normal day. Nothing special to write home about here. The Eliza, it is plumb full of passengers with well over 1,200 bales of cotton. That night, everyone had retired to bed, when the weather suddenly acts up. It's bringing freezing winds, and somehow, some of the cotton bales catch on fire. Maybe a lantern was too close, and the winds did the rest. I'm not really sure exactly how this all went down. What is known is this. The location where the fire occurred made it impossible for people to reach the lifeboats. So with no other options, people, in their pajamas, mind you, they weren't prepared to battle the cold. They began jumping into freezing water down below. When it was obvious something was wrong, locals on land, they did not hesitate to jump in their own boats and go help people struggling in the icy waters. In addition to this, the Magnolia responded and they came as well. On fire, she continued her journey, weaving in the water, until she finally got close to Pennington, where the Alabama Highway 114 now resides, sinking right by where now is an old bridge called the Nahiola Bridge, a unique structure that I'll be talking about in just a few moments. Charles Mackay described the heartbreaking scene, quote, "And when morning at last dawned upon their sufferings, it was found by the sad survivors on counting their numbers that 28 were missing and had only escaped the fearful but a quick death of fire to perish by the still more feared because more lingering death of cold." Unquote. Rufus Ward talks about the Eliza battle in his book, The Tumegee River Steamboats, Roladors, Deadheads, and side wheelers. This may be a theory of his of how the fire may have started. He shares that At 1 a.m, the Eliza passes a steamer known as the Warrior, and that smokestack sparks from the Warrior landed on the Eliza, and that's how the bells of Cotton caught on fire. The high winds, well, they just did the rest. And I quote AlabamaHeritage.com. Pilot Daniel Epps tried to reach the shore at the outbreak of the fire, but the Tumegee, having flooded to the bank, provided no place to land. With no other option, he drove the steamer into the trees, which would be the salvation of some. As passengers in their nightclothes clung to them for safety, cutting winds and a hailstorm made the night bitterly cold, and many passengers had to make the choice between the flames of the ship and the frigid waters of the Tumegee River. Survivor Charles McKay said, quote, "Precious human lives ebbing away upon its dreary banks were the only sounds audible except for their own prayers and lamentations, and the wailing cry of a young child dying in its mother's arms. After a couple of hours, one little baby froze to death, dropped from the hands of its young mother, too benumbed to hold it, and falling into the swamp below, was lost from sight." Unquote. Sadly, in her short few years of service and existence, the Eliza battle grew a notorious reputation, being involved in several accidents, more than a few close calls, and even dealing with other fires and running aground. So it's no shocker that she would eventually sink. While we may not know how the fire started that fateful March evening in 1858, what is known is that several people died that day, and that it's considered the greatest maritime disaster in the Tumegee River history. To this day, many people claim to have seen the Eliza Battle, now considered a ghost ship, still in flames, navigating the waters near Pennington, Alabama, where she sank over 166 years ago. Author Catherine Tucker Windham, she talks about the ghost ship in one of her books titled 13 Alabama Ghosts and Jeffrey, and I quote, "Eliza Battle can still be spotted on dark nights, floating along the Tumegee, engulfed in phantom flames. Sometimes music can be heard, drifting across the river. The presence of the ship is a bad omen that purports to foretell impending doom." Unquote. Now, the location where the Eliza finally accepted defeat and sank is right by the Nahiola Bridge. It's a unique bridge, and according to Southwest Alabama, it's, quote, "one of only a few bridges in the world that accommodated rail, auto, and river traffic," unquote. It was built in 1934 and shuts down in 2001. It's a vertical lift bridge that was specifically built for usage of the Meriden and Bigby Railroad. It also raised up to allow large barges below to safely pass. RuralSWAlabama.org shares more about this really neat bridge. Quote, "In 1958, Marathon Southern opened a new paper mill on the Choctaw County side of the Tumegee River. Many mill workers who lived in Marengo County had to travel long routes just to get to their job because there was no highway across the Tumegee at the mill. This problem was resolved by retrofitting the Nahiola Railroad Bridge so that auto traffic could travel across the river on it. Creosote-treated railroad cross ties were placed beside the rails on the railroad tracks to allow traffic to straddle and travel along the tracks. Traffic lights were mounted at each end of the bridge to signal auto traffic whether to stop or to proceed. The lights were necessary because the bridge was only wide enough for one-way traffic, and motorists could not see from one end of it to the other because of a curve near one end of the half-mile-long structure. The lights were used to warn motorists of the presence of a train or when the drawbridge was raised to allow river traffic to pass underneath. Because of the bridge's multi-use, the railroad hired bridge tenders who managed traffic 24 hours a day. traveling across the old bridge in a vehicle was always a memorable experience, and it could be terrifying at times, especially at night when it was foggy or there was stormy weather. There was always an uneasy feeling crossing the old railroad bridge. The bridge was very narrow, and there was the curve that prevented seeing from one end of the bridge to the other. There was rails on each side of the bridge, but were they tall enough to keep you from tumbling into the Tumagee River if there was an accident? When crossing the bridge, you would always hope that the green light was correct and that there was not an approaching train or a raised drawbridge. The bridge was also old and rickety, and the rail cross ties on the bridge were bumpy and uneven. This did not help to calm your nerves when crossing the bridge. Crossing the bridge could be especially frightful in a large vehicle or on a motorcycle. A biker had to be very careful when making the half-mile journey across the bridge to prevent the tires on his motorcycle from falling into the crack between the rails and the cross ties, unquote. Wowza, that's a bit too nerve-wracking for me, not knowing if a car, train, or the bridge is up. Quite the gamble. No wonder they finally decided to call it quits. In September of 2021, 20 years after it shuts down, this old, unique bridge is added to the Alabama Register of Landmarks and Heritage. Next up is something legends are made out of. A haunting tale about a death ship. The ship of the Platte River. A haunting tale lurks in the background, and I'm about to expose the hell out of it. This mysterious unnamed vessel takes us to Wyoming, and it's been seen roaming the Platte River for well over a century. Armed to the gills with a full dead crew, it's said that if someone sees this ship, it's a warning that someone close to you, well, they're soon going to perish. And right on cue, my garage cricket is talking to me. Before the sighting takes place, a thick, foggy mist is seen. Think Jeepers Creepers, except it's not the creeper that comes back after several year hiatus, but it's the bloody ship of death. I quote Legends of America, quote, "The phantom ship rises out of a strange mist that quickly becomes a massive ball of fog. As the ship grows closer, witnesses report that its sails and masts are covered with frost. The crew, also covered with frost, stands upon the deck, huddled around a corpse lying on a canvas sheet. The legend continues that the ship always foreshadows the death of someone who will die on the day it is spotted. As the crew steps back, the corpse's identity is revealed as a person known by the witness." Sightings of the ship of death certainly did pay the price, as these three individuals did lose someone close to them that very same day. And it's not like a, "How dare you see my vessel? I'm going to make you pay." No, it was more like a, "Hey, you are about to endure a hell of a lot of heartbreak, and we're letting you peek behind the veil." The first documented sighting of this mysterious vessel dates back to 1862. The unlucky soul to witness the frozen death ship was Leon Weber. One September afternoon, Leon, a fur trapper, and his dog, they were beginning a month-long trip. Things were going fine so far until they witness a mist on the water that takes the shape of a large ball. The dog anxiously, he hides behind his master. He's whining, he's whimpering, he's growling. And it's said that Leon, he grabs a rock and he throws it at this mysterious mist ball and it bounces off and it's making a loud sound like it hit something hard. It emerges from the mist. Emerging from the mist then comes this ship. I quote, "Only in your state." Over 100 years ago, a trapper named Leon Weber reported his encounter with the spectral ship. At first, all he saw was an enormous ball of fog. He rushed to the river's edge to get a closer look and even tossed a stone at the swirling mass. It immediately took the form of a sailing ship, its mast and sails covered in silvery, sparkling frost. Weber could see several sailors, also covered in frost, crowded around something lying on the ship's deck. When they stepped away, affording him a clear view, he was stunned to see it was a corpse of a girl they'd been looking at. Looking closer, the trapper recognized her as his fiancée. Imagine his shock when he returned home a month later to learn that his beloved had died the same day that he'd seen the frightening apparition, unquote. I read on Fexcology.com that the dead crew watched Leon intently as he walks closer to the ship. He sees the woman, and they say the corpse was his wife, not fiance, so unsure which is accurate. There's other differences in their version as well. Quote, as Leon let out a pained scream, the ship and mist vanished. Leon cut his trip short, rushing home to ensure his wife was safe, but upon arriving, several in his small town had already gathered outside of his home, where his wife was found dead earlier that day. I mean, in my opinion, that version would make more sense. You cancel your month-long trip, you get back home as quickly as possible. Not, 30 days later, oh no, she did die that day. Shit, that sucks. The next sighting takes us to 1887, 25 years after the fur trapper Leon Weber and his beloved Pooch saw the death ship. Next up is a cattleman named Gene Wilson. He was out one late afternoon rounding his herd close by the water's edge, while his dog begins to act rather erratically, barking wildly at the water. His loyal canine is not the only creature to be acting strangely. You see, Gene can't help but notice that his horse is also on edge, very agitated, very nervous. The horse, in fact, straight up refuses to go near the water. Now, this is odd. Usually there's no issue whatsoever, but today? Well, today is different. The horse then proceeds to run off. He manages to capture it and ties it to a nearby tree. When he makes his way back to the river bank, he shares that the scene that lie before him, quote, set my nerves a tingle, unquote. I quote Fexcology.com. Approaching it, he could see the layers of the ice covering not just the ship, but the nine ghostly men who stood motionlessly staring at him. It was then he started to hear the heavy sounds of steps coming from the inside of the ship, when a spectral captain appeared in front of the men. His frosted eyes stared at Gene as he made a motion for his men to bring forth a large object covered in a canvas. Four men brought the object in clear view of Gene. One gripped the canvas, pulling it back, revealing the lifeless body of a woman who had been badly burned. Gene later wrote, the face of a woman who seemed to be terribly burned, in spite of the frightfully scarred face, I recognized my wife. Overcome with terror, I screamed and covered my eyes. When I looked again, the ship had vanished. Unquote. Well, this terrified Gene to no other. I mean, who would not be frazzled at a time like that? He runs to his horse, unties him from the tree, hops on, and gallops towards home. As he approaches a hilltop, he stops. You see, this hilltop shows the perfect view of his home, and a dark plume of smoke is rising from where his home should have been. He gets there, and he sees the house is gone, sitting in rumbles and shambles, ruins. His wife, who was home when he left, well, she's nowhere to be seen. That is until he finds her body laying dead about 100 yards away from the remains of the home they once shared. And the next and final documented case of an unfortunate person to see the ship of death is Victor Hebe in 1903. Victor was right near the North Platte River one day, chopping firewood. He stops to take a much-needed cigarette break. It is during this break that he's puffing on the coffin nail that he sees this mysterious fog, and it's approaching him from the water. And as it gets closer, it takes the shape of a sailing ship. And Victor can't help but notice that it's completely covered in ice. Only in Your State paints a better picture. Quote, a cell blocked Victor Hebe from getting a clear view, but he could see there was a crew standing on deck. He could also hear voices. Hebe claims to have heard a man's voice asserting that he was innocent and another man's voice responding that they were only carrying out their duty. And at that point, the cell blocking Victor's view was drawn up and the scene he witnessed was chilling. On the forward deck stood a gallows with the man's body hanging from it. At the point, with the ship being less than 20 feet from the bank where Hebe stood, he got a direct look at the face of the man slowly swaying at the end of the noose. It was his best friend, who had been tried, and Hebe felt wrongfully convicted of murder. The last Victor had heard, his friend had escaped from prison. He would later find out that the friend had been captured and put to death the very same day Victor encountered the death ship. Unquote. Months before he saw the ship of death, Victor had been in court at, and I've mentioned this name before on the podcast, Tom Horn's murder trial, testifying that his friend was an innocent man and he did not commit the murder that he was being accused of. I quote Faxcology.com. All right, but I am telling you that you are hanging an innocent man. One of the crew responded, yet none of the men in front of Victor moved their lips. It replied, that is not for us to determine. You were tried and convicted of murder. A canvas sheet dropped from behind the man, revealing the gallows, and at the end of the crossarm, a lifeless body swayed, rocking back and forth along the ship. As the body turned, Victor recounted, it was the face of my dearest friend, he whom I had defended with my testimony in court at Cheyenne only a few months previously. Victor shut his eyes at the sight of his dead friend, but when he opened them, his friend and the ship and the mist, they were all gone. He gathered his items, rode into town desperate to find information on Thomas. To his dismay, he discovered Thomas Horn had in fact been hanged that very same day. Horn. He sure made a name for himself in history. He was a man that had many talents. In the Old West, he had made quite a reputation for himself as being a Pinkerton agent, which is huge all on its own, a cowboy, a soldier, a range detective, and much, much more. And after working several years in Wyoming and Colorado, he gets kind of bored of things and he begins the life as what many consider a hired gunman, killing at least 17 people. In 1902, he is accused and convicted of the murder of a 14-year-old boy, and on his birthday, at 43 years old, Tom Horn is legally executed via hanging. Many people respected and honored and loved Tom Horn, and believed to the very, very end that he was not guilty, including his very dear friend, Victor Hebe, who saw him hanging from the death ship. And Tom Horn, he was buried in Boulder, Colorado. And to this very day, many people still believe in his innocence. Even Geronimo truly believed that they were hanging an innocent man. And when it comes to the execution itself of Tom Horn, only a few died this way during the Wild West days. I, of course, am not talking about hanging, as that was the main way. But the type of hanging itself. It was conducted on the Julian Gallows, something I've talked about in Season 4, Episode 183, titled Death by the Julian Gallows and More at Wyoming Frontier Prison. It's a water-powered gallows, and it's designed back in 1902. The trapdoor is connected to a lever that would yank out a plug, which was connected to a very large barrel of water. Now, due to this, the lever, with the counterweight, would rise up, and it would withdraw support, and the trapdoor, well, it eventually opens. EyewitnessHistory.com gives a front row seat to the execution. Quote, Proctor adjusted the noose, formed with a conventional knot of 13 wraps to Horn's neck, drew a black hood over his head, Smalley on one side and a friend of Horn, T. Joe Cahill, on the other, lifted the doomed man onto the trap. Instantly, the sibilant sound of running water permeated the breathless stillness. The instrument of death had begun to operate. To the straining ears of the listeners, that little sound had the magnitude of that of a rushing torrent. Smalley, his face buried in the crook of an arm resting against the gallows tree, was trembling. "What's the matter?" came in a calm tone through the black cap. "Getting nervous I might tip over?" Seemingly interminable, the sound of escaping water ran on. "Joe," said Horn, addressing Cahill, "they tell me you're married now. I hope you're doing well. You treat her right." Indubitably, he was the best composed man in that chamber of death. Still the sinister sound of running water, then mercifully, the leaves of the trap parting with a crash, and Horn's body hung through the opening. 31 seconds had elapsed since he had been lifted onto the trap. He fell only 4.5 feet. His head and shoulders projected above the gallows floor. The drop was not sufficient. His neck, not broken. Proctor had feared to arrange a longer drop, apprehensive that stoppage of the fall of a body so heavy as Horn's might tear the head off. The slam of the massive hangman's knot against the side of Horn's skull knocked him into unconsciousness, however, and he did not suffer. For 17 minutes, the physicians, with fingers on his pulse, felt impulses as a mighty heart labored on. Then the pulse ceased. Tom Horn was dead, unconfessed, unquote. So here we have 3 documented cases about sightings of the ghost ship / death ship, where 2 men unfortunately saw their fiancé and wife dead. Then we have the man who saw his best friend being legally executed, and all of these individuals died the very day the sightings occurred. This would make a wonderful movie. I did mention I was working on a ghost ship episode to somebody, and after I had already done the research for this particular episode, this person did mention a couple of others, so there will be a part 2 at some point. Not sure when, but keep an eye out for that. Do you know of a ghost ship or a ship of death that you did not hear about today that you believe should be in part 2? Feel free to reach out to me at parapral@gmail.com. Also, it is that time of year again where I am still looking for people to be a part of the annual Halloween episode. So if you have something to share, whether it's heartwarming visit from a loved one or something bone-chilling, I would love to hear about it and have you be part of this amazing, much looking forward to episode. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They are all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single damn one yet? Well, there's really no need to worry. You can hit up any of those amazing podcast platforms such as Blueberry, CastBox, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Deezer. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everyone, and I will
see you next week.